It was something to do, right?
Yeah, busy work.
All right. All right, speaking of guns, most people don't realize that when we talk about the First World War, that it was in fact a world war, that there were battles on every single hemisphere, every single continent, with the exception of Antarctica, on Earth. The same is true in the Pacific. There would be conflict in the Pacific because the same reasons why there was conflict in Africa. There were colonial possessions that would be targeted for seizure. And of course, one of the most aggressive nations in terms of this violation of international law was the Brits. The Brits simply decided to take advantage of the fact, as we said last class, that the German Navy was all bottled up in the North Sea, whereas the English ships still had free range on the world's oceans. So they decided they would take advantage of the fact that the German colonial possessions in the Pacific essentially were not guarded. And like a $20 bill laying on the ground when you're walking down the hallway, how many of you bend over, pick it up, and immediately go door to door to figure out whose $20 bill is it? Or would you simply put it into your pocket? So, England had the advantage. They had imperial troops, all of the sepoys in India that they could utilize. But they also had Australian troops and New Zealanders that they could use to strike out at German bases. And with relative ease, the Brits were able to take Samoa, which was a German territory, along with the other half of the islands, American Samoa, and they also took control of New Guinea, which was once a German colony. The Germans there put up minimal resistance, to be truthful. And I have no idea on casualties. I'm guessing, because the fact that I couldn't find any, that it was probably insignificant. We'll just say nil. But in August, Samoa was taken real quick. In September, New Guinea was taken. But it wasn't just England that was going colony scooping. No, 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 no. There also was another world power in the Pacific that envisioned imperial conquests. And that would be the Japanese. Now, in my global history here, in my global history class, I do devote a little attention to the emergence of Japanese imperialism. Just real quick, in the middle of the 19th century, after the Americans arrived and basically broke open Japan for centuries of isolationism, the Japanese went through what is known as the Meiji Restoration. They basically got rid of the shogunate system and replaced it with a direct imperial system. But the Japanese built their reforms on a combination of the German and the English systems. So they modernized. They modernized their government. They modernized their army. And of course, they modernized their industrial capacity. The problem was Japan was not mineral rich. So the Japanese found themselves in kind of a catch-22. To be a modern country and not be conquered and exploited like what happened to China and India and all of the other parts of the world, they had to be strong by Western standards. But to be strong by Western standards, they needed access to minerals. So, beginning in the 1890s, they began doing the same thing that the Europeans were doing. They put their military into operation, and they went and fought a war with China and kicked the living snot out of the Chinese. And they took spheres of influence in China. And then similarly, they deployed their modern navy, and they went out and they expanded their reach beyond the traditional home islands. Well, it would be using this war machine, which, by the way, they proved in the Russo-Japanese War, when they destroyed the entire Russian Navy, both the Pacific and the Atlantic fleets. But anyways, they would use this and began picking off the other regions of German territories with ease. They seized the Mariana Islands. They seized the Carolines. And they seized the Marshall Islands. All territories that, under the rules of effective occupation, the Germans had all legal right to. But who was going to stop them? Ironically, Japan, as we should remember, was an ally of England. And it wasn't discovered until after the war, but the Japs and the Brits had made a deal. Everything north of New Zealand would be Japanese. Everything south of New Zealand would be Brits. So the Japanese, wanting to maintain their friendly relations, engaged in it wholeheartedly. Now, ironically, Australia objected to it, but England didn't listen to Australia. Second note. Ironically, during the peace conference at the end of the war, many of the territories that Japan would take would be taken away and would be given to the English or the Americans or the French. And that was one of the many factors that would lead the Japanese in the 1920s to being gritting their teeth and planning eventual revenge. Well, in addition to the islands, and again, I don't really have much more to say about that, they also decided this would also be a good opportunity to eliminate the German spheres of influence in China and take possession of it for themselves. Why? Again, because they could, and no one was going to stop them. In particular, was the huge point of Qingdao. So here's Korea. Right here is Port Arthur. This is where the bulk of the Russo-Japanese War would be fought over. But Qingdao was here. Vast, deep harbor that the Germans did spend millions of dollars in infrastructural development. And it sat on a peninsula, putting it midway between Beijing, the capital, and Shanghai, one of the modern thriving ports of commerce. So location, location, location. Germany technically had a 99-year lease. And in the middle of it was a massive fortress that was built by the Qing in 1871 that the Germans occupied and modernized. So, big harbor, they had a legal right to it, and they boosted up the military capacity. And the fort was in a perfect elevated position. There aren't many pictures that I could find. But here's the main city, Qingdao. Here are the forts. This is the forts. And at each position, the Germans built modern gun emplacements and had heavy artillery located within it, along as other minor positions that had machine gun points. But basically, they had the capacity to fire upon the entirety of the harbor. So the Japanese wanted it for the locations, but in order to take it, they would need to deal with this.
military capacity. Now, by the way, for those of you under the age of 21, when you get to be 21, you have the right to engage in the consumption of delicious adult beverages. And one of the big beers that can be purchased, particularly if you like going to Chinese restaurants, is Qingdao. That was actually a German brewing company. The Germans made that beer. That formula is a German beer. So that's the reason why it's different than some of the other Chinese beers that are available, because it's based on German purity standards. Now, I don't know if the Japanese wanted the brewery, but I know if I was going to lead an occupation force, that would be high on my list. All right, anyways. August 25th, 1914, the Japanese would launch a massive amphibious invasion, combining both landing crafts and the good chunk of their modern navy, which included 4 battleships, 2 cruisers, 15 destroyers, and they were supported by a British pre-dreadnought battleship. They managed to land a force of 50,000 men that had 100 field pieces, and they would lay siege to the fortification. Despite the fact that the Germans only had about 1,000 men there, they held the Japanese at bay for over 2 months. And in the end, the Germans held out until they basically were out of ammunition and could no longer defend the walls. The Japanese would suffer almost 7,000 casualties, whereas the Germans suffered only about 400. Well, once this was over, pretty much there would be no other battles in China. This is the only military target that was of value held by the Germans. But interestingly enough, the Japanese would seek to take advantage of the fog of war. Not only could the Germans not defend their colonial possessions, but none of the other European powers that had influence over China had the ability to do so, because they were kind of distracted. England and France and Germany were distracted on the trenches of the Western Front, and Russia and Germany and Austria, they were kind of distracted on the Eastern Front, and then the Italians and the Austrians were distracted in Italy, and of course the Brits and the French and the Serbs and all the rest were distracted in Salonika. So while all that was going on, the Japanese sat back and said, "The Republic of China is pathetically weak. So why don't, instead of taking a sphere of influence, why don't we take control of the whole country?" Now, 1914 was a perfect opportunity, because the ancient imperial system, which China was ruled by for 2,500 years, came to an end in 1912. In a revolution of sorts. When the Qing Dynasty, the last dynasty of China, controlled by the boy King Puyi, officially came to an end, one of the leading warlords, Generalissimo Yuan Shikai, would seize control of China and would be declared its military protector, aka a dictator. Joining him was a political revolutionary by the name of Dr. Sun Yat-sen. And together, the warlord and the political revolutionary would seek to create a new government system of China. That would be known as the Republic of China. government was, no pun intended, a paper tiger. All of the problems that resulted in the downfall of the imperial system were still present. The economy was abysmal. Infrastructure was abysmal. There was corruption. They were technologically and economically backwards. All of the things that allowed the Europeans to come in and carve up China. Well, despite their best efforts, they could not fix the problems. So just a few months before the start of World War I, the two made an agreement in which their attempted constitution would be temporarily suspended, and Yuan Shikai would be given full dictatorial powers. He could control the military, he would control the finances, he would have control over foreign policy, and yes, the rights of the Chinese people themselves. The idea was tight fist, hold everything together, and give them a chance to go back and revisit political reforms with the hopes of going back to the idea of a constitutional republic. So China, it's at its weakness just as Japan arrives. You're walking down the street, and there's a little kid with a bag full of money. I wanted to see who would think about that, and I can see someone who's thinking about it. My impression of you just completely changed.
I'm just laughing.
So, seeing what was going on, like Chris apparently would do with that little child walking by with a bag of money, Japan decided to pounce. January 1915, a Japanese emissary arrived in Beijing and met with Yuan Shikai and his advisors, and they were presented with this document up here. How many of you can read Chinese? Because those are not Japanese characters. Those are actually Chinese characters. No? Well, that's known as the 21 demands. Now, included in the list was obviously the big one. China had to transfer to Japan legal control over the German possessions that it took. But Japan also demanded control of all of the railroads that went into Qingdao, no matter how far they went out. They also demanded the right to patrol the coastline, the entirety of China. Because they had a navy, China did not. Any city that they had a sphere of influence over, they demanded full power over in terms of law and policing. They also demanded full control over all of the railroads in Manchuria and in Mongolia. Because up there is where all the mines were. They also demanded control over mineral rights. So wherever China had coal, wherever China had iron, Japan would control it for the Chinese. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. They also, in the list of demands, demanded that China no longer give any more rights to any other outside country. So pretty much whatever all of the Europeans had, that was going to be it. Because from now on, all the rights were going to go to Japan. Oh, and lastly, Japan would take control over all of the banks in China.
Effectively, Japan is going to do to China what France did to Morocco.
Well, Yuan Shikai's government appealed to the Entente. They sent word to London, they sent word to Paris, and asked for help. But we already know what London and Paris were focused on. So unfortunately, they never responded. So Yuan Shikai's government was forced to accept most of the terms.
But they never agreed to allowing political or legal control over anywhere in China, or police control.
So they gave up the railroads, they gave up the banks, they gave up the economy, they gave up the mineral rights, but Yuan Shikai reserved the right to basically have sovereignty. In 1915, 1916, 1917, the Japanese are exploiting the Chinese all across the country. China figures it's done, that it's going to be a colony of Japan. But in 1917, China's hopes changed. Because as we're going to see in 1917, April, the United States would enter the war, declaring war on Germany. Well, the Japanese were hopeful because when we get to the last exam, we're going to see the rhetoric that Woodrow Wilson would use in basically justifying the United States' entry into a war that we really had no business getting involved in. The biggest focus of his argument was that all people on earth had a right to self-determination. That they had a right to essentially govern themselves. So, Yuan Shikai gambled that with Wilson's friendship, when the post-war world is created, he will help the Chinese get rid of the Japanese. Which he would do. That would be another thing the Japanese would be pissed off at us about. But as a result of the United States' entry into the war, China also would declare war on both Austria and Germany. And believe it or not, they actually sent soldiers and personnel over to the Western Front. Most of them served as laborers, but there were some soldiers over there as well. Questions? All right. Well, we've already laid out that by late in 1914, this had become a world war, and this global war was definitely a problem for Germany. Germany could not compete globally because, as we said, it couldn't get to its colonies, and it couldn't get to its possessions. And it couldn't even get its navy out. So how can you be a global power if you can't defend yourself? One interesting side note. Adolf Hitler, in Mein Kampf, argued that Germany's pre-World War I focus on colonies was one of the biggest reasons why they lost, among many other factors. I shouldn't say biggest, but it definitely was a big reason. And that's the reason why the Nazis did not pursue colonies, but instead they pursued border expansion. So instead of having a little here, a little there, a little there, a little there, which would require an excess of tremendous resources and a massive navy, they focused on expanding in the continent. Because it was easier to expand your borders than it was to control the world. Just FYI. But of course, if we recall Kaiser Wilhelm practicing Weltpolitik, believed that Germany had a right to seize its rightful place under the sun. And it was during the Kaiser's government that these colonies were obtained. So, this is a huge problem. To make matters worse, there was no way to change the situation. England's shutting down of global access by simply putting some dreadnoughts in the English Channel and some more dreadnoughts in the North Sea essentially was effective, and it didn't require the Brits to do anything. The ships could just simply maintain their positions. As long as they were in sight range or communication range, they could effectively serve as a complete lockdown. So how do you stop a force that doesn't require actions to be effective? That was a problem. Because Berlin realized the only way to do anything about it was to confront the blockade. But you put a ship in the middle of the sea, and it's going to go against another ship. What's going to be the outcome? Can you control the outcome? No, this was an immense risk. An immense risk. So by trying to fight the blockade, by breaking the blockade, they essentially could break their navy. Kind of like trying to polish your car's bumper by slamming it into a brick wall. Now, Tirpitz, the architect of the German Navy, as well as German naval doctrine, argued that Germany had to respond. Germany needed to respond aggressively, because if the German Navy was not used, to use his words, the fleet would be, and I quote, embalmed. Essentially, it would be like going to calling hours at a funeral home and looking at your lost loved one, all pumped up through those chemicals, so that way they look nice for your final goodbye. So the fleet would look nice and shiny, but the guys wouldn't know what to do, and you don't even know if it could work. So he believed that the German Navy had to be used, and if the German Navy was used, that Germany could achieve victory. But he was going against the largest navy on Earth. Why did he think he could win? Well, he believed that German technological standards were better than British technological standards. So, one-on-one, he believed that the German battleship was stronger than the British battleship. So he's in Berlin, he's at the general staff meetings, he's making his arguments, and nobody supported him. Little if all, few if all, or any, rather, agreed with him. And in fact, the biggest person he had going against him was not only all of the leaders of the war machine in Germany, but was the Kaiser himself. The Kaiser supported a policy known as Kleinkrieg. Klein, that's the German word for small. Krieg, strike. So Tirpitz is saying, let's unleash our entire fleet. But most of the other naval advisors that have the Kaiser's ear are saying, no, 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 we don't need to send out our dreadnoughts. Dreadnoughts cost millions of dollars to make. We can do smaller things that are cheaper that could be just as effective, such as torpedo raids. Germany by 1915 would have more small torpedo boats than the British did. So we all know what torpedoes are, right? Pretty much you take your little boat, you sail in quick, don't give the battleships a chance to react, fire your torpedoes and zip away. They also argued for the use of untethered sea mines. In fact, in British papers, all throughout the war, it was very common for a big British sea mine to show up on a British beach. Because they just would build them, arm them, and set them free. Oh, and let's not also forget the Unterseeboot, the submarines. So most of the people that had the Kaiser's ear said, not one big grand battle, but we could slowly, little cuts, effectively break the British will to maintain the blockade. Now, ultimately, that would be adopted, and that would remain in place for the first 2 years of the war to little actual effect. The reason why the Kleinkrieg, the little strikes, didn't work was because of the commanding officer's policy and strategy who ran the blockade. Sir John Jellicoe, he approached the blockade not like a fighter, but like a stockbroker. He felt duty-bound to protect the taxpayers' money. So, when you have money, when you become adults and go into the real world and get a J-O-B, are you going to invest in companies that are fly-by-night, high risks? Or are you going to be more conservative? Are you going to risk it in the market? And by the way, I can't tell you how many companies that I invested in over the years that literally ceased to be. They went bankrupt. And all that money just went poof. Or are you going to take that money in instead and put it in a nice savings account? Sure, you might not become rich, but at 2 or 3% annual interest, it will slowly grow. Well, an investor in the market may get rich, but they may lose their shirt. Whereas somebody who puts their money in the bank at least will have something. So Jellicoe believed that the Brits could win by basically not losing. So he wasn't going to risk death and loss of life and loss of investment by simply avoiding fights, even if the Germans tried egging it on. So what does this mean? Whenever enemy ships were detected, he ordered them, his ships, to pull out of range, to always kind of be just out of reach, which ultimately would piss the Germans off and cause them to make a mistake. So what you ended up having is the German position would be defensive in nature, as would be the British position. And at the end, one defensive idea stymied the other defensive idea, and nothing would happen for 2 years.
boring. Boring, boring. So let's see if we can spin the globe and find some action. Well, outside of the North Sea, there actually would be a couple of skirmishes. Nothing big, though. Because the Germans were not able to get their full navy out before the blockade was put in place. Now, we've already learned about the Goulben and the Breslau. This was Germany's Mediterranean fleet that when World War I began, they raced to the security of Constantinople. And technically, they would transfer it over to the Ottomans. These two ships would be utilized to rain terror on the Russians' Black Sea fleet. Basically decimated Russian naval capacity. Russia didn't have anything close to these vessels. And all throughout the war, they basically had control. So they made the Black Sea an Ottoman lake. But there actually would be a skirmish, a battle, in the Pacific. Off the coast of Chile, near the city of Coronel. German commander Maximilian Graf von Spee had essentially control of Germany's South Atlantic fleet. When the war was declared, Spee took his ships and sailed into the Pacific because, unlike the Argentinians, the Chileans allowed the German ships to come in and get resupplied. The problem was the Brits got wind of these German vessels in the South Pacific, and London ordered Sir Christopher Craddock to engage and destroy. Now, ironically, Spee's mission was to wreak havoc. So essentially, if you come across a British merchant ship, send it to Davy Jones's locker. Craddock feared that Spee would attempt to attack Argentina, from which a lot of foodstuffs were being transported to help feed the British soldiers. So against the advice of his subordinates, Craddock took his ships, sailed around the southern tip of South America, and came up on the Chilean coast to try to knock out Spee. The problem was, Spee's ships were bigger. He had two heavy cruisers and three light cruisers. Whereas Craddock, on the other hand, had two aging, like 19th century cruisers, one light cruiser, and a 20-year-old battleship, the Canopus, which was so slow, Craddock left it behind and just basically sailed off and left it alone. Now, this is a map of the naval positions of each side. The blue ships are the Germans, the red ships are the Brits, and Spee, as you can see by the map, if you can see, took advantage of the fact that he had bigger, faster ships that had longer range weapons. The only way Craddock could be effective against the German ships was to sail within gun range. So that way he could get his ships in the gun range. But as you can see, not one, but two of the four ships that came to attack Spee were lost. The Monmouth and the Good Hope. In total, nearly 1,700 lives were lost. Craddock himself was lost in the attack. And of the crew on the ship, when the ship sunk, only 5 men were saved. Only 5 men managed to jump overboard and were not dragged down when the ship creates that vacuum as it sails, sinks underwater. Now, by the way, this battle was significant, even though it was minor. It was the first significant naval victory in the history of the German Navy. And it was one of the first losses by the British Navy since the War of 1812. The last naval defeat occurred on Lake Champlain when the American ships sunk all of the British ships in 1814. Well, with Craddock dead and British strength essentially neutered, Britain's response was to take immediate action to remedy this lopsided loss. They did so by dispatching Vice Admiral Sir Frederick Sturdee. His orders were to intercept speed. Now, whereas Craddock's ships were old and dated, Sturdee's squadron had 2 modern battle cruisers, both of which were eventually would be used in the Dardanelles, one of which, the Inflexible, would be sunk. Just FYI. Plus, he also had 6 other light cruisers. He would, unbeknownst to Spee, sail off the coast of Argentina and would take anchor in Port Stanley. There was no GPS, there was no global communication networks, there was no wireless transmitters that the Germans had possession of, so Spee essentially had no idea that Sturdee had arrived. He figured he could essentially engage in what he was ordered to do, terrorize the waters off of Argentina and intercept British merchant shipping. Well, that's not quite the way it turned out. Spee literally sailed right where the enemy was. His attack would begin on December 8th. Now, as lopsided as the Battle of Coronel was, the Battle of the Falkland Islands was worse. Sturdee confronted the situation with confidence. He knew his ships were bigger, faster, better armored, and better armed. He would turn his heavy cruisers when he got word that Spee was coming and put them into battle positions. He then dispatched his light cruisers to kind of do a big pincer movement. So here are the Germans. They sail towards Port Stanley. They see the British ships and they attempt to flee. He then pursues, and there's his light cruisers. And he essentially would attempt to do pincer movements. And over the next 8 hours, he would engage.
the end, Germany would lose both of its heavy cruisers and two of its three light cruisers. 2,100 lives lost, including Spee and his two sons. Britain suffered only minor damage. Spee's guns couldn't hit the British ships. They were too far away. The Brits, however, would suffer 21 casualties. So with that, the Battle of South America pretty much comes to an end. There would be no other skirmishes anywhere else on the globe because all of the rest of the German ships are in the North Sea. Questions? So now, the colonies are gone all around the world, and the only German ships that are not in the North Sea are here in the Black Sea. So that takes us to the only major naval battle in World War I. And it would not occur until 2 years later. The Battle of Jutland. Now, ironically, pundits, naval experts, talking heads, believed that the clash between the German High Seas Fleet and the British Grand Fleet was not only likely, but it was inevitable. They believed it would happen. So it wasn't a matter of if, it was a matter of when. But the problem is Jellicoe, 2 years on, still had no bloodlust. Even though he did send out patrol ships, there never was a major clash. And the Germans, any attempt they had to probe the blockade, that was only done with small, little, expendable ships. So ironically, the North Sea was just like the Western Front. You had two military machines essentially locked in a stalemate, with neither one able to get an advantage. Well, that was until a change occurred. In early 1916, Grand Admiral Tirpitz resigned. He resigned in an argument with the Kaiser. Tirpitz had been in favor of German naval policy and its use of submarines, and in particular, unrestricted warfare. But as we're going to see, in the winter of 1915, a British commercial vessel called the Lusitania was hit by a submarine and sunk, and a bunch of Americans were on board. And the last thing the Kaiser wanted to do was to bring another nation into the Great War. So the Kaiser squashed, temporarily, the use of naval warfare, submarine warfare. Tirpitz got pissed, so he submitted his letter of resignation, and interestingly enough, he would end up going into politics. Well, his replacement as Grand Admiral would be Reinhard Scheer, a young, energetic, dynamic leader. He managed to convince his superiors that now was the time to engage with the Brits. His plan was to lure out of position, trap, and then destroy a portion of the British fleet. He hoped to engage the squadron commanded by David Beatty. Now, seeing how just about all of you have no knowledge of how the military works, besides the common boots on the ground, there are officer academies. And at these officer academies, there tend to be international exchanges in which officers of one nation has the opportunity to go and meet and possibly train side by side with officers of other nations. Or at the very least, they become knowledgeable on the officers of other nations. And they use that knowledge to help determine policy. Well, Scheer actually had met Betty in their youth. And Scheer knew that Betty was a bit of a hothead. So unlike Jellicoe, who was as frightful as a mouse, Betty could be lured into taking action. So Scheer believed he could basically get up in Betty's face and trick him to pursue, pulling his ships out of position, which could then be encircled and sunk. And what that would do is it wouldn't break the whole blockade, but it would force the British to have to reposition its ships and basically stretch it so thin that it would be more like a sieve than an actual pan. In other words, they would be stretched so far out that the Germans could break the lines or run the lines and gain access to the Atlantic, and then the war would completely change in its dynamic. The plan was to pull Betty's cruiser fleet, which had been stationed near Scotland, right there, to lure him out, while Jellicoe would still maintain the outer barrier. Betty's fleet, 4 heavy cruisers. So, if we could knock out this squadron, that would cause a reaction, like I said, that would shift things. One of the things that it would do was it would force Jellicoe with his 32 ships to, again, just to be redundant, to spread the lines. Well, Scheer realized you couldn't knock all of Jellicoe's fleet out, but you could knock Betty's out. Plus, ships have a tendency to break down and require a ton of maintenance. So essentially, there would be no way for Jellicoe to even have all of his 32 ships out there. And again, then you can punch the line. Now the battle, it was all planned. The operation would take place on May 31st, 1916. And the idea was a T. A small portion of the German Navy, commanded by Captain Hipper, would be the bait. And they would sail out in attempt to catch Beatty's attention. So they're going to get in their face without fully engaging.
They then would turn and run. And as they ran, they would pull Betty closer and closer to German waters, which would allow Scheer to blast in a northerly direction, like a T. So, Scheer would be the stem, Betty would be the cross.
But if you have your ships sideways and the enemy's coming straight at you, the weakest point of the ships are exposed to the strongest position of the ships.
Questions? All right. How are you going to get them out there? Well, to get Betty's ships out to where he could engage Hipper, they would use submarines. And they would send out 10 submarines that would basically fan out and would attempt to scare, show their position to get Betty to pursue back towards the trap. So the subs were the bait to get them to the next bait that would allow Scheer to do the tea. Unfortunately for the Germans. Sorry, this is money. Actually, they want me to do it. Stop, that's not money. This is money. Fortunately for the Germans. Come on, load. Ooh. Dennis. Yeah, that's fine. Actually, hold on. I get the advantage. Let's see if I can get them for 185. Sorry, I'm being lawyerly. The submarines did have wireless technology. And the Germans, by design, used the Imperial Code. The problem was, is unbeknownst to the Germans, in 1914, a German light cruiser ran aground in Russian waters. While the German sailors managed to blow up half of the ship, the code books were unharmed as they were in an internal safe. So, while the ship was rendered useless, when the Russians boarded the ship and began going through it looking for valuable assets, they stumbled upon the code books. They copied them and gave copies to their allies. So the Russians, the Brits, and the French all had German naval code books. And the Germans didn't change it for 2 years. So as the German submarines are sending their coded message, the Brits are sitting there and they get everything and they discover what the plan is. So what do they decide to do?
Well, let's spring the trap.
Betty does pursue the submarines and comes within contact of Hipper, but unbeknownst to Scheer, Jellicoe fires up all of his ships and steams in the same direction. Oh, this is good. 16 dreadnoughts, 6 pre-dreadnoughts. Oh, wait, that's Scheer's force. Hold on. There we go. Jericho's fleet was made up of, just dreadnoughts and super dreadnoughts. whereas the Germans' fleet was 16 dreadnoughts, 6 pre-dreadnoughts, 6 light cruisers, and 31 torpedo boats. Outgunned, out-armored, outclassed. So, as predicted, Betty cites Hipper. That's actual long-range picture that was taken of Hipper's command ship. They were discovered, and basically this is up here. They were discovered at approximately 3:30 p.m. And Betty's force, unbeknownst to German planning, had an additional 2 battlecruisers. So instead of the 4 dreadnoughts, he now had 6 ships, which was more than was anticipated. And Betty was steaming, full steam ahead, but he had the smaller, faster ships in the rear. So all Hipper saw was the 4 ships, and he didn't realize there were more ships behind him that would basically come out to attempt to ensnare. So we're going to trap the trap with another trap. Well, unfortunately, Hipper reacted quicker than Betty had anticipated. By distracting him, by engaging in, as you can see, all kinds of crazy maneuvers, which would cause Betty to constantly have to go and reposition itself. Well, at about 6 p.m., Scheer shows up. Earlier than expected. Betty knows Scheer's force would decimate his own. So at about 6 p.m., he feigns a withdrawal. He pretends he's going to retreat. But he retreated in a direction that would be supplanted by Jellicoe's fleet. So instead of teeing with Betty, Scheer tees with Jellicoe. Between 6:30 and 8:30 p.m., the two combined fleets would engage twice. This would be a ferocious naval engagement of historic proportions. 14 British ships, 3 battle cruisers, 3 armored cruisers, 8 destroyers sunk. The Germans would lose 11 ships, a pre-dreadnought battleship, a battle cruiser, 4 light cruisers, and 5 destroyers. The Brits would lose 6,100 sailors to the North Sea, whereas the Germans would lose 2,500. And throughout the night, the two fleets attempted to outmaneuver the other one, with Jellicoe constantly trying to encircle Scheer to prevent him from sailing back to safe waters. Now, unfortunately, under the cover of darkness, the fleets got separated. Jellicoe hoped to pursue once the sun came up, but unbeknownst to Jellicoe, Scheer ordered his ships to travel full steam ahead, and he retreated back to port. Well, Jellicoe thought that he was going to be lured into another trap, so instead of pursuing, he retreated. Now, I read four books that where I got that information from, and the historians were split. Jellicoe had suffered significant damage, and two of the intellectual experts said they believe that if Jellicoe pursued, it's possible that Scheer could have used the coast as his backside, basically turned his ships, and inflicted more damage to the Brits. Whereas the other two seem to suggest that if Jellicoe came in, his guns had longer range, and he possibly could have sunk the German ships in harbor, or at least entrapped them. But we'll never know, because Jellicoe retreated and Scheer stayed at home. Now here's the funny thing. Both sides immediately said they won. German newspapers heralded as a significant victory for the German Navy, just like the British newspapers did. But here's the thing. With military battles, it comes down to numbers. The Brits lost more ships and lost more sailors. They succeeded in keeping the Germans at bay, but the Germans had already been at bay for 2 years. So the Brits definitely didn't win. And at the same time, the Germans didn't really break out. So once again, for the remainder of the war, it would be defense, stymieing defense. And to make matters worse, Jellicoe himself would be removed from his position after the Battle of Jutland, because the powers that be wanted a huge victory like the Battle of Trafalgar, in which Lord Horatio Nelson sunk Napoleon's entire fleet. But again, like I said, the experts that I read were equally divided because of the cost-benefit analysis. If Jellicoe pursued and lost, the Germans would have been able to get out. And that was a loss that Jellicoe couldn't handle. So even though he was pulled out, the decision was the right decision, I think. And simultaneously, it proved that Scheer was an nincompoop. Yes, the Germans could be proud of their performance, but high losses. And Germany by 1916 didn't have the financial or the industrial ability to replace those ships. So even though German ships seem to be more technologically advanced, in the end, the Brits maintain their control over the Atlantic. As one British newspaper put it, I love this quote, "The German fleet has assaulted its jailer and it's now back in jail." So if any of you are going to go into prison, you know, you want to be a guard. Yeah, a prisoner may attack you, but the prisoner is going to end up back in his cell. Not only was the Battle of Jutland the only significant battle of the war, but it also was historic. Because since the Battle of Jutland, there has not been another naval battle in which battleships were the focus of the engagement. What piece of technology put an end to the dominance of the battleships?
Submarines?
Nope. I think World War II, Pacific.
Aircraft carriers.
The airplane put an end to the battleship. Because what can an airplane do?
Well, it can get up to where a ship can, and it can drop bombs on it from the air, and those big guns can't do anything.
Yeah. Pearl Harbor. Think of what a couple of hundred Japanese bombers were able to do to the American Pacific Fleet. And if you ever go to Pearl Harbor, you will be able to witness with your own eyes the remnants, because the Arizona is still there. Questions? All right, well, I went a couple of minutes over last time, so I owed you a couple of minutes, so we'll call it a class. We're going to come back, and we're going to move into 1916. And all Thursday, it's going to be Verdun from the beginning to the end. Papers. We only got another week and a half if you're going to try getting it in for early submission. If you get it in by the end of March, like I said, I think it was like plus five. After that, the paper's due in April.